From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Wendell Berry joins us in the hour ahead, a leading writer of fiction, poetry, and essays, as well as a much-respected spokesman for agrarian values, conservation, and ecology. He'll be with us in studio for a wide-ranging discussion, and that's on the next Forum Hour. You're invited to join us and, of course, join in after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our forum program. The author of over 50 books of fiction, poetry, and essays, Wendell Berry, makes another appearance here on the forum program. He's been a farmer for most of his adult life, but he's also very respected for his work as a conservationist, an ecologist, and environmentalist. And just this past April, he delivered the 41st annual prestigious Jefferson Lecture in the Humanities. He recently was awarded the National Humanities Medal and the Cleanth Brooks Medal for Lifetime Achievement by the Fellowship of Southern Writers, as well as the Lewis Bromfield Society Award. His most recent books from Counterpoint Press include A Place in Time, 20 Stories of Port William, and It All Turns on Affection, which includes the Jefferson Lecture as well as other essays. He joins us for the second hour of the forum program. Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, Michael. Thank you.
Welcome back. Well, where do we begin? Actually, you know, I begin talking about Wallace Stegner because he was a very important figure in your life.
Yes.
Remains a very important figure in your life.
Yes, he does.
And in your Jefferson lecture and in your essays, you talk about boomers and stickers, which is a Stegner dichotomy. Very important in the vision and world of, well, Wendell Berry.
Yes. It was an extremely important concept to him because it came out of his own experience, his own family experience. But then he applied it and accurately, I think, to the life of our country. And he thought that the boomer, the person who came to make a killing and get out, was the dominant figure in our culture, and that the sticker, the housewife, for instance, who wants to plant a bed of perennials and see them bloom year after year, is a minor figure.
But one who sticks to the fidelitous way and doesn't necessarily hit and run. In fact, I was kind of moved by your writing about your grandfather in this context and the founder of Duke University. There's that big statue for him. He's the boomer. And
yes,
your grandfather may be obscured by history were it not for your writing.
Yes. Well, some of my conservative friends didn't like that comparison very much, but they belong to what I've begun to call equal-time intellectuals. They think if you say something bad about a corporation, you ought to give equal time to saying something bad about your family or kicking your dog.
I'm thinking about what your conservative friends say to you along those lines and thinking about boomers and stickers. You have become probably more identified with sustainability than anybody I know or anybody I've read. And yet that's a tricky word, and it's a word that you've maybe even feel has become kind of overused and abused, like some of the words we hear from our conservative friends. In fact, didn't you say you were talking about how sustainability maybe is not only a difficult word, but it means stickers. It means permanence, really.
Yes. The difficulty of the word is, one, that it's a single word, like green or natural or those organic, those other words that have become bumper stickers and have been adapted by anybody for any purpose. But we're stuck with it because sustainability, after all, is a requirement if we hope to continue to live in this world. That is to say, if we humans do as a race. And the problem for us Americans is that we haven't been here very long, and we haven't sustained anything even as long as we've been here.
Well, as a farmer, you talk about the nutrients and, say, organic materials that are taken from the land and must be returned to the land.
Yes.
That's not quite an American concept for the boomers, is it? Or
it's not a concept that we've lingered over, but it was a concept that was established in the agricultural conversation 50 or 60 years ago by the English agriculturist Sir Albert Howard, who spoke of the fertility cycle as the wheel of life in which all creatures pass through the cycle of birth, growth, maturity, death, and decay, round and round, again and again. And if that cycle, that wheel, doesn't turn in place, then we're turning all the things we depend on into finite quantities that we're using up.
Is that why you think?
Including food.
That's why you think maybe we need a 50-year farm bill rather than a 5-year farm bill?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Let's expand a little bit on this because presently, as far as agriculture, the perennials versus the annual crops really kind of tie into this whole notion. But you're talking about ecology largely with 50 years, aren't you, planning?
You're talking about trying to identify what the indispensable natural requirements or natural laws are, and then doing our best to obey those laws in our land use practices. And the 50-year farm bill approaches our agricultural problems by way of what I think is the primary law of nature, which is that the land should stay covered with living growth the year round.
Talking, if you just joined us, with Wendell Berry, his new books included All Turns on Affection, the Jefferson Lecture and Other Essays, as well as A Place in Time, 20 Stories of Port William, and we'll talk about Port William. But nobody is more identified with the importance of agriculture to our society than you, and also the importance of small family farming, small-scale farming, whatever you want to call it, and strong local economic pinioning everything in the small economic realm, if you will. And as a result, sometimes I wonder when I read you and I've read you through the years if you're talking about maybe going back to when agribusiness didn't have the kind of hegemony it has or the strength it has, or go back to an agrarian time, a pastoral time maybe even, that just doesn't exist anymore, that we can't go back to.
Well, we don't have we Americans especially don't have – we European Americans especially don't have much behind us that we should go back to, because our record here has been pretty bad. We've really reduced the thickness of the mantle of topsoil. We've cut down virtually all the original forest. We've mined out much much more than our share of the combustible minerals. We've poisoned most streams, the whole atmosphere, the water cycle, and so on. And so we need to look ahead. There are some things behind us that we can look back to. My father based a lot of the work of his life on the idea that a family with a small holding of land should be able to make a decent income and live a decent life. And that, to me, is a worthwhile ideal, because we've never really reached it.
Oh boy, it was rough for your grandfather. He was in debt, we read in your new work.
Well, my grandfather was born in 1864, and he lived through the Depression of the 1990s, the agricultural depression.
The
1890s. Yeah. The 1890s, yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. The 1890s, the depression of the first decade of the next century, and the depression of the 20s and 30s. Agricultural part of that depression started 10 years early.
I'm also struck in your work. You just recently received the Kleanth Brooks Award, and so much of that work of Kleanth Brooks was a kind of Southern agrarianism. Talk about the school of new criticism with Brooks and Alan Tate and John Crow Ransom and those writers. There's also, when I talk about looking backward and maybe can we really go backward, I think about a writer named Leo Marx who said it's always been a tension between the machine on the one hand and the garden on the other, you know, sort of that dichotomy. We want to get back to the garden almost like we want to get back to a Garden of Eden, an innocence time that America had. Well, but the machine has been just moving onward. And I mean, you see things that way, don't you?
Leo Marx and I happened to meet in a public conversation one time, and we agreed on a good deal, but finally parted company. Because he really was a technological determinist. He really thought there was nothing you could do about it. My side of the argument is not that we need to junk all the technology, but we do need to subordinate it to the primacy of natural reality and natural law.
And a belief in really the natural beauty. I mean, that comes through in your work perhaps more than everything else. You are kind of a Wordsworthian.
Well, I may be a kind of Wordsworthian. I certainly think that if a thing is healthy, it's going to look healthy. And to that extent, you can take the world's natural beauty as a sign and that we ought to pay attention to. I don't think that you can very successfully argue that we advance ourselves very securely by making things ugly. My friend Guy Davenport, who was my colleague for a while at the University of Kentucky and has been dead now for some years, wrote an essay called Making It Uglier to the Airport, in which he argued, I think correctly, pretty much that nothing in existence is worth as much as anything that theoretically might replace it, which is to say that everything's reduced to its market price now and is in jeopardy.
Well, if that's the case, one can be pretty gloomy, and you're not. I mean, you do tend to be somewhat more sanguine than most who say we've become so commercialized and commodified as a society that and industrialized that we can't turn it back.
Well, I don't live my life in unrelieved glee, but I do know some very good people, and I have experienced in my life a lot of love, and a lot of goodness, and a lot of beauty. And I know that even in this sometimes very discouraging advocacy that I've carried on, it's been possible to accumulate some very amusing allies and have quite a good time.
And also treasure and cherish the whole sense of community. I mean, that comes across in your work and has consistently through the years. Port William is all about community.
Right? Yes. That has a lot to do with my experience of the old neighborhood work swapping that used to go on in my part of the country, where all the difficult jobs were done by crews of neighbors. And the old rule of that association was nobody's done until everybody's done. And as I experienced them, these exchanges of work were not very carefully accounted. Nobody ever knew who owed what.
They weren't keeping score.
They weren't keeping score.
They were just working together.
They were working together, yeah, because of somehow they had that fundamental understanding that there's no such thing as anybody's full potential as an individual. The full potential of the neighborhood came from cooperation and the help and the company and the affection of other people.
Well, you mentioned your conservative friends. They seemed to take umbrage when the President of the United States spoke about, you know, you didn't get here alone. It took other people to get you here. And
yes.
It caused a firestorm, really. Huh?
Well, I didn't. I don't think they were very securely founded in principle or fact on their side of that controversy. Everybody's in debt. And the true conservatism, which I'm pretty willing to subscribe to, the true conservatism requires us to understand our indebtedness to others and to the world, and to acknowledge it and to repay it generously, not necessarily to the ones from whom you've received it who may be dead, but to the ones who are coming on, the ones still to be born, need to be repaid.
Talking with Wendell Berry, he's with us, and he'll be actually appearing at Herb Theater tonight, part of City Arts and Lectures at 7:30, and on a panel Wednesday, 4 p.m. at UC Berkeley's Zellerbach Hall. You also write about, and this seems to be something of another era, and I don't know, maybe it's still out there and it's extant and it's something that needs to be encouraged, but like killing of hogs with reverence and they're not squealing as a result, or livestockmen saving a calf falling through the ice. I mean, those kind of attitudes of people who are raising their own livestock or, you know, it's very unusual. It's very rare, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I don't think it's rare among livestock people. Who take very seriously, I think, by and large, their obligation to their animal dependents. And when those people are at work rescuing and caring for their animals, I don't think the primary thing on their minds is the bottom line. There's affection. There's satisfaction. There's that the really great satisfaction in seeing your animals eat and thrive.
It all does turn on affection for you, huh? As the title suggests.
I don't know whether you can. It's that title implies to me that it all should turn on affection, that the good things of the world do turn on affection, and I don't know how else they would turn. You may think that it's incredible, as I said in something I wrote recently, that it's a little incredible that everything should depend on love, but what's really incredible is that anything should last or survive without it. So we who live at the expense of other lives, there's nothing we can do about it. Being a vegetarian doesn't stop it. We live at the expense of other lives. And to do that without affection and without good care and without forethought of the survival of these good things is, to me, obviously and demonstrably wrong.
So sustainability, we're back to that, depends also on affection. Yeah. Love.
John Milton, in his poem Coma, says that nature means her provision only to the good who live according to her sacred laws and the holy dictate of spare temperance. I've thought about those lines for many years, and the longer I think about them, the truer and richer they become.
I'm impressed you can still quote your Milton. You've got it down pat. Let me give out the phone number, an opportunity for you listeners and fans of our guest Wallace Berry to actually join conversation with him, Wendell Berry, excuse me, to join conversation with him, and we do welcome your calls and emails. You can call us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join this conversation with any questions or comments you have for Wendell Berry, who is often described as a modern-day Henry David Thoreau. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. You can also post any questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or join us by going to our Facebook page or tweet us. And our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. There's all that new technology right there, Wendell Berry.
All right.
What do you say? Remember when Al Gore was, well, vice president, even before that, there were people who gave him a hard time about being a tobacco farmer. You know, you may recall that. What do you say to that? Tobacco farming.
Oh, they have given me a hard time for that. One thing I have to say is that I come from a family of tobacco growers. There's no question about that. I never did grow a crop of my own, but it was the staple crop, the universal crop in my area, and as a part of my living in the neighborhood, I worked with my neighbors in their crops. So that, I suppose, I took part in the tobacco planting and harvest most of the years of my life.
It also gave you your ethos, though, didn't it?
Give me
your ethos.
Well, the emphasis on quality was very high in tobacco, especially. Well, that's a complicated history, but before filters began to mess up the quality issue. So it was an advantage to a writer to grow up in a community in which everybody aspired to be an artist, to do to make the most beautiful result possible of their year's work. And also, a writer couldn't have had a better gift than to listen to the conversation that went on at the times of that crew work.
Of course, you didn't know at the time how destructive tobacco was.
Well, we didn't until 1964, I think. Was that when the year of the Surgeon General's report? About in there, the mid-60s. So we had proof then. And ones of us who were involved then were and who were in some sense taking part in the public discussion realized that they couldn't in conscience defend the crop any longer. But I did continue, and I still do continue to defend the program, the federal tobacco program that started under the New Deal, and is now, of course, gone and has been for several years. But I did defend that program, which I think was a model agricultural program and is worth study if somebody who would like to study it can get past the stigma of tobacco.
Hard to get past, but we'll continue this conversation with our guest, Wendell Berry, and you can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And you're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio, and I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Wendell Berry, writer, critic, farmer, author of a couple of new works published locally by Counterpoint Press, Jack Shoemaker's outfit. It all turns on affection, the Jefferson Lecture and other essays, and also A Place in Time, 20 Stories of Fort William. And as I think about the rather strong influence that Wendell Berry has had, and I spoke about his ethos before, it has to do with community, and it has to do with gentility and a reverence for the land and the natural world, but also one can never downplay civility and kindness. I mean, in terms of your world schema and what you have to, perhaps strong word to use, but proselytize or teach us would be a better word, has a lot to do with civility and kindness, doesn't it?
Say that again, Michael.
Civility and kindness is so important in your worldview in terms of the way people need to be with one another and interact with one another. Central.
Yes, it is central. Kindness is a great word, and it means finally that we treat each other as if we are of the same kind, which we are. And to do that doesn't cost us anything. It's a very cheap commodity.
You also have become probably more singularly identified with the so-called slow movement, slow food movement than anyone. Do you still strongly identify with that movement? Because it's taken on so many different avatars.
Sure, I'm willing to be identified with the slow food movement. But I've also been saying that I belong to the slow communication movement. And slowness is not a bad idea if it's associated with patience and good work and those
virtues.
Those
old school virtues. Where are you on this presidential election? Because we've heard a lot about the free market from Governor Romney and President Obama, at least at first, seemed to be tending his own garden, like Voltaire told us we should do, and his wife concerned about food and slow food.
Well, of course, I'm not for the free market. My family's opposition to that is now going on 100 years old. The tobacco program was founded to protect the producers against the free market. Because it was understood that the free market would destroy the producers if it were not restrained. I'm going to vote for Obama. But I don't think you can tell everything about me from that statement. I have some bones to pick with the president. And I'm not happy in the recognition that I and my friends and allies really don't have at this time a political side. Those of us who are trying to advocate for good land use don't have a political side. We don't have a powerful political ally. And so, in a sense, politically, I'm a patient man waiting for the day when I have a side in the political, what do they say, arena.
Well, you've been certainly identified with the environmental movement in a very singular way, but you've also been critical. You say, I believe at one point, many environmentalists simply place too much importance on wildlands without acknowledging the importance of agriculture.
Well, I don't think that the importance of what I would call the economic landscapes have been ever adequately acknowledged by the so-called environmental movement or the conservationists. And Wes Jackson says that if you can't save the economic landscapes, the agricultural landscapes, the forest landscapes, even the mining landscapes, maybe preeminently the mining landscapes, you can't hope to save the wilderness areas. There are too few of them. And nature, after all, is happening all over the place. And she's being very badly abused in the economic landscapes. But the fate of the economic landscapes is not on the agenda of the conversation about economics. Economics, as it's being used, so far as I can tell, refers to the financial system. It doesn't refer to what I would call the economy by which we actually live and breathe and drink and enjoy ourselves.
Wendell Berry is our guest, and our first caller is Harn. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Just first, thank you for your voice and for Mr. Berry's voice on this subject. I have an observation and then a question. My family has Century Farms back in Emmitsburg, Iowa, that I've worked with quite a bit. And we are sort of have three legs to our farming stool. One is still in commercial corn and soybeans with the GM products that come off that. Another is in organic row crops, and the third is a new effort at vegetables and pasture-raised livestock. So it's I found myself in a unique position to observe these three different farming models. But I also look out on the economy, and we live in, apparently, I think, in a world of exponential growth, exponential depletion of resources, exponential growth in debt. And we live on a planet that is very finite. And so I'm wondering, and I'd like to hear from Mr. Berry on this, if we aren't at a tipping point where there is no choice but to go back to a model that is much more considered of natural systems, because we're running out of peak everything that our current agricultural system is dependent on, and it will not make economic sense, let alone environmental or social sense.
Maybe we have no choice in going back, as we were talking about earlier.
Well, as I said earlier, I don't think there's anything behind us that we could solve our problems by going back to. The traditional agriculture that I grew up in was fairly good, but it very readily broke down in the face of the industrialization of agriculture, which really began to move very rapidly at the end of World War II. The question about what makes ecological sense could be just as well framed by as a question of what makes economic sense. And what does make long-term economic sense in agriculture is a question that we're not bothering to answer. The country I live in, much of it is rolling, sloping, highly vulnerable land, highly vulnerable to erosion. And almost suddenly, that land has been invaded by corn and soybeans, genetically modified, herbicided for weed control, and that is not sustainable. The problem with undoing that is that we've reduced the farm population to such a tiny minority that how we would staff a better agriculture to begin with is a problem. But we need to think about it. What we've done, and we're doing it all over the place, is substituting technology for human labor. You can find it out. I just found out this morning by trying to call KQED on the telephone and talk to somebody. All you can get is information that somebody supposes you want. You can't get from the robots who answer the telephone the information that you actually want. So
we'll give you our private number before you leave.
So anyway, I just had that on my mind. One reason that people are suffering from unemployment is that one of the primary goals of the Industrial Revolution is near to being realized. That is the replacement of nearly everybody by some form of technology. And it's happened big time in agriculture. The costs are toxicity and erosion. There's runoff of nitrogen fertilizer from these Midwestern grain fields, and that has become pretty notorious. Everybody knows about that. Everybody knows about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Very little is heard about the runoff of herbicides from herbicided corn and bean fields. But I just talked to a trapper the other day who told me that a stream that had been very productive for him suddenly died, and the reason for its death was herbicided corn and bean fields in the creek bottom. Well, there's not many people are observing the countryside anymore. The countryside is almost deserted, and it's interesting that this testimony would have come to me from a trapper who is a person who's interested in the landscape all year round. He's not just there on a vacation. He's not just there for planting or harvesting. He's there all the time with an interesting question on his mind. What's going on with the creatures?
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more of your calls in a moment. I want to go to some of your emails, though. Pamela writes, when I read Wendell Berry, I become a better human being. I am deeply grateful to him. And Wade from Petaluma says, actually a couple of responses to what you said about livestock and vegetarianism. He says, the guest speaks of livestock people as having a natural affection for animals. Whatever affection they may have does not filter down in a factory farm. Most of the animals humans exploit for meat do not know the loving touch of human affection in any significant way. Being a vegetarian or vegan definitely and dramatically reduces human-caused animal suffering by bypassing the need for animals in the food supply. Nutritional science does not support the need for animal products in our diet.
I could interrupt to agree with that, absolutely.
Yeah. In fact, what you were saying is, I think along those lines, that when people work with livestock in a community and a small farm and everything, mm-hmm. it's a totally different attitude than agribusiness.
I wrote an essay called Stupidity and Concentration, if the writer would like to hunt that up.
Well, here's Annabelle who comments online, says, while it's true that being a vegetarian vegan will not end world consumption of animals, it does alleviate suffering. Not eating other creatures is the most affectionate and loving thing we can do for them.
Well, we ought to eliminate suffering to the extent that we can, and we ought to take care of things to the extent that we can. Living creatures deserve our respect and care. A certain amount of suffering is going to happen, and I repeat that we can't live except at the expense of other creatures. Just taking up space eliminates other creatures from existence, let alone driving an automobile or flying in an airplane, which I just did. And, you know, I would have to plead guilty to that. I don't think I should have, but I did.
Here's Jack, who joins us next. Jack, you're on.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Michael, for another excellent show. And Mr. Berry, I became a big fan of yours. I think it was 1984. I heard you speak at a conference on the fate of the Earth in New York City. And I'm wondering what you think about the trajectory of climate change, because I've heard things like the ice caps are melting about 80 years faster than anybody expected. And the second thing I would like to know about is what do you think about replanting the earth and, you know, creating good soils and replanting the earth as a way of sequestering some of the carbon dioxide that's in excess now?
Okay, that's two questions. I'll try to remember both of them. The 50-year farm bill is concerned chiefly with replanting the earth, that is, with perennial plants that live year-round and that harvest sunlight and hold the ground in place in all the seasons of the year. Now, what was the other part of the question?
Well, the trajectory of climate change.
Oh, climate change. You know, I can't speak about climate change from my own knowledge. It seems to me from my experience with this subject of climate change, like my experience with my doctors. We now live in an age of faith, almost like the Middle Ages, although the subject, the objects of faith have changed. But I know about climate change and take it seriously only because of the testimony of the comparatively tiny number of people who do know about it. And it seems to me to be a good idea to take their word for it. I think maybe the emphasis ought to be shifted from climate change to the things that cause it, namely waste and pollution. Those things are more available to the comprehension of ordinary people like me. I, for instance, live in the Ohio River Valley, where to breathe the air is dangerous. And this doesn't have anything to do with smoking. It has to do with exhaust and smoke from factory flues and so on.
You read Bill McKibben? He's coming to town, and I just
yes, I've read Bill McKibben at some length, and I have a great respect for him, and I'm his ally.
Let me thank the caller. Actually, along the line of climate change, a listener in Oakland, Merrily writes, I'm curious to hear what your guest thinks of the book by Paul Gilding, The Great Disruption, Why the Climate Crisis Will Bring on the End of Shopping and the Birth of a New World. You know?
Well, that's a book among the many thousands that I haven't read.
Well, we'll get to a few more maybe before the hour is over. Actually, here's somebody I know you've probably read. A listener, Tim, says, I hear in Mr. Berry's thought the echoes of John Ruskin's There Is No Wealth But Life. I'd like to hear Mr. Berry's thoughts on how Ruskin's thought matters today as we try to rediscover what real wealth is. And I must add, I thank God for you, Mr. Berry. Thank you for your work.
Well, I appreciate that. And these compliments that are coming here are very, very humbling to me and humbling because I know myself better than my critics. but anyway, yes, I would buy that proposition. The only wealth we have really is life. We have our own lives. We have the lives of other people and other creatures, and these are properly identifiable as wealth simply because they enable us to live. The life in this world is the real money.
Well, here's some more remarks to humble you in your self-effacing, modest way. Listener Michael writes, when I was a young man in the 1980s, Mr. Berry helped put words to what I was trying to express. I changed my focus in life and became an arborist here on the peninsula. Thank you for your craft and beauty. And Emmy writes, Michael, thank you for hosting Wendell Berry today. He is a true inspiration to me and an excellent role model for our country. I am working as an outdoor educator, and I'm trying to bring the conservation about sustainable agriculture and food systems into the classroom. I think that it is a very important topic and can be an excellent tool to inspire humility, empathy, and citizenship. I would love to hear Wendell Berry's opinion about education and sustainable local agriculture and how we can make it more accessible to our schools.
Well, my conversation with Wes Jackson, which has been long and diverse,
it's in your book here, in fact.
Yes.
And It All Turns to Affection.
Has sometimes turned to this question of education. And we've wondered, we've proposed to ourselves that you could make education much more local without making it at the same time what is called pejoratively provincial. And that simply is by asking questions like, what has happened here? What was happening here before we came? What has happened since we came? What has happened that should have happened? What has happened that shouldn't have happened? What should be happening now? And the interesting thing about those questions is that to answer them responsibly and fully would require all the disciplines. They couldn't be answered, for instance, in a department or by a teacher. Somebody would have to be called in for help. So if you're going to talk about local food, local agriculture, local gardening, why don't we talk about local history, local geography, local ecology, and those subjects?
We should probably mention that Wes Jackson, whom you mentioned a couple of times, is the founder and current president of the Land Institute that deals with and has dealt with sustainable agriculture. I want to get another caller on here, and that's you, Neil. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Mr. Berry. I'm a fellow poet, and when I started writing some years ago, a professor told me I should be looking to your work for guidance.
I beg your pardon.
Oh, no, I consider it to have been quite positive. But I wanted to mention this idea of economics that you raise. One of the possible solutions to this that I've been thinking about is a sort of a national balance sheet where by inventorying all of our natural resources and giving them a value, then every time a particular economic activity occurs which diminishes their value, like air pollution or water pollution, it shows up on the balance sheet as diminished. And there's a cost that we can actually assign to that loss.
Yes, I don't see anything wrong with that. I think it ought to be carried out as well on a smaller scale of states, regions, communities, that sort of thing. Would put it much more within the reach of the comprehension and responsibility of individual people. But that kind of balance sheet ought to be kept. And what you're essentially defining and what you said is a land use policy, which we don't have.
Which we should have.
We should have. Yeah. Without it, we simply have the political situation we have in many places, and that is the people of power are simply passively reclining in the presence of the people of wealth. In Kentucky, for instance, the politicians just get out of the way of the coal industry and other industrial corporations.
Our guest is Wendell Berry, and he was recently awarded the National Humanities Medal. Joining us here in studio and author of A Place in Time, the 10th volume in his series about the mythical town of Port William. And I'm actually looking at a listener who says, please let Mr. Berry know how much pleasure his Port William stories and novels have given and continue to give me. I began with Hannah Coulter and was hooked. I've read all the novels and short story collections, and I'm currently in the middle of reading A Place in Time, slowly, to savor every word. The deep caring for family, home, and the land is evident in all his stories and touches my heart. This is from Claudia, by the way. And she says, in A Place in Time, my favorites so far are Fly Away Breath, which, when I finished it, teary-eyed, felt it should be read out loud in a group setting, and A Desirable Woman, such a tender love story. My deep thanks for creating these wonderful characters who inhabit Port William. And, you know, when I'm reading Port William stories, I'm often thinking about, and I don't want to make you even more humble here with more praise, but I'm often thinking about East Rutherford, New Jersey, and William Carlos Williams. You know, you're in the American grain, as we like to say.
Yes,
yes. Have you seen influence?
Well, very much. And in fact, I wrote a little book in appreciation of William Carlos Williams, simply because he was a sticker. Lived in the same house, you know, all his life, practiced medicine from his home, and served his local community, and emphasized always the importance of the ground underfoot. And these kind words about my Port William fiction simply makes me grateful to my work, which I feel very much has been a gift to me from other gifts of the people I've known, the place I lived in, and so on.
What about your lineage and your DNA? And don't those figure in as well in terms of?
Oh, maybe a little bit, but I think my great gifts have been my family, my associations, my place in the world, the teachers I've had. I think if you subtracted those things, the DNA would be fairly uninteresting.
Well, place is everything for you in many respects, isn't it? I mean, I think of your work like I think of Faulkner's. It's that little postage stamp of reality.
It has become so, but it's become so because of my own limitations. I didn't live... I was raised in the place that I now live in. I've lived in it for most of my life, and I have found it ever more interesting and revealing and beautiful and consoling.
Well, with all this gratitude that you have for all these positive comments. Would you like to hear one that's from the other side of the fence?
I think we should, yeah.
All right. Here's Henry, who writes, Barry may have a large following, as you like to say, but he sounds like an ignoramus to me. Being critical of technology replacing human labor in agriculture, he should read accounts of what Iowa agriculture was like when agronomist Norman Borlaug was a teenager. And as for runoff of herbicides and pesticides, they are mitigated by the cultivation of genetically engineered crops. I seem to have missed his or your endorsement of them.
I don't think they're mitigated by the introduction of genetically engineered crops. As for being an ignoramus, of course I am. I know a lot less than what I don't know vastly exceeds what I do know, but I do know what agriculture was like before the introduction of these modern technologies, because I've worked myself in those circumstances. On the accusation of ignorance, of course, I can only plead guilty.
Me too. people think I know a lot, but the more you learn and the more you know, the more you realize how bloody ignorant you are, as the British would say. Thank you for spending this time with us. Appreciate it. Wendell Berry, again, is appearing tonight at Herb Theater with City Arts and Lectures at 7:30. He'll be on a panel Wednesday at 4 p.m. at UC Berkeley's Zellerbach Hall, and he'll also be participating in a reading and discussion on Thursday, November 1st at 6 p.m. at the Berkeley Art Museum Theater. And reminder, he's now has a couple of books out there, A Place in Time, 20 Stories of Port William, and It All Turns on Affection, the Jefferson Lecture, and other essays by Wendell Berry. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Irene Noguchi, and Amanda Stupai. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.